as long as it's beneficial for you as well. Because the time really flies with these sorts of discussions, and that's because they are discussions. They're not lectures, they're not classes, they're participatory. So hopefully we can bring our own experience and our own curiosity and contemplation to the teachings of the Buddha and bring them alive for ourselves. So that is my main wish for these sort of discussion groups, that we bring the teachings of the Buddha into your own room, into your own home, and certainly more fully into your lives. Yeah, hello from Crystal Beach, Canada. Another person just arrived. So hi, Charmaine. And so you may remember, many of you may have been here a couple of weeks ago, and we did a sutta called the Simile of the Six Animals, which is from the Samyutta Nikaya, Salayatana Samyutta. That's chapter 35, about six sense bases or the six senses. And we talked about the senses being like six animals that are tied together with string and are pulling in different directions. They're tied together with probably quite strong ropes. So you've got all these different animals. You've got a snake, a crocodile, a bird, a dog, a jackal, and a monkey. And they're all pulling towards their own feeding grounds. So it says here that the snake pulls one way, thinking, let me enter an anthill. The crocodile pulls another way, thinking, let me enter water. The bird pulls another way, thinking, let me fly up in the sky. The dog pulls another way, thinking, let me enter a village. The jackal would pull another way, thinking, let me enter a charnel ground. And the monkey would pull another way, thinking, let me enter a forest. And these are unfortunately not actually six different animals living separately, are they? If these are our six senses, they're all pulling different ways within ourselves. So in a sense, we're being split. It's like a competition between the eye and its objects, the ear and the sounds, the mind and all the thoughts about it. And we're just being constantly dragged into these worlds and pulled around, as it were, by these ropes. Without a lot of control, right? A rope seems to imply that we're something of a slave to the senses. And the problem here is the rope is not tied firmly to anything. And then the Buddha uses the simile of mindfulness of the body being like a pillar or a post. So instead of just pulling and the strongest one wins, you have this post that the six animals are tied to with this rope. And they keep pulling. The bird tries to go up. The dog goes to the village, the monkey goes to the forest, but eventually they get really tired and they start to settle down. So then they start to sit down near the post and eventually go to sleep. So the post in this simile is the mindfulness of the body. So the Buddha's talking about this as being one way to guard or restrain the senses. And there's a lot more to that sutta. It talks about the mindfulness of the body and developing a measureless mind, which really means the mind gone to greatness, the mind in its apamana state. Apamana literally means mind without measure. And that's usually a simile for deep meditation, for the jhanas, which can be accessed through various practices. Usually the breath meditation is very common, and also the metta meditation, or even meditation on compassion, on mudita, altruistic joy, or rejoicing joy, I like to call it, and equanimity. And then from that place where the mind is purified of the hindrances, we have the opportunity. Here it just says one understands, as it really is, liberation of mind, liberation by wisdom. So liberation by mind is the jhana state itself. Liberation by wisdom is probably talking about really seeing non-self. So understanding, gaining insight into the Four Noble Truths. So, and this is where unwholesome states cease without remainder. So it actually goes all the way to full liberation when unwholesome states cease without remainder. So this is one description of sense restraint. We stop being pulled around. We start to settle our minds, we're able to still the mind to the point of deep samadhi where the hindrances are overcome, and then we have the chance to see things as they are and develop that deep wisdom that destroys is kind of full on, isn't it? It says those evil, unwholesome states cease without remainder. It basically means greed, hate, and delusion cease. So today, I thought we'd continue with the subject of sense restraint by looking at another of my favourite suttas in the same chapter, and it's just a few suttas earlier. The one I just referred to was number 247, I think. And now we're going to number 240, and this also includes animals. So this is called the Simile of the Tortoise. And before we start, I'll just give you my little theory. It's one way to understand these suttas, in that there are different kinds of sense restraint or guarding the senses. And to me, the last one was more about guarding, and this one is more about quietening. I might be wrong. It might even be the other way around, actually, now I look at them again. But basically, there's a way to use our senses that is wise and that helps us move towards the wholesome qualities increasing and the unwholesome qualities decreasing. So it's related to how we perceive or what we attend to. You know, do we look for the faults in other people or do we look for their beautiful qualities? You know, if you're always picking out the faults, not only do you get upset with the person, but you actually start seeing more and more and more and more and more and more and more faults because you're getting primed to see the faults. And this has been proven in neuroscience that actually the more you see a certain way, the harder it is to stop seeing that way. And so that's one kind of being with the senses, being with sensory experience that helps us to train our minds and gradually increase the wholesome. But there's also a way of practice that starts to really quieten those senses. And I guess both of them refer to that as well. But this one is really nice. And I thought it relates to what I'm about to do, which is to go on to retreat for a week. So let's just get into it, shall we? Look, Manori's put in the Pali, which is very helpful. Kumopama. Kumopana. Kumopama. Yes. So that means tortoise, I guess. It's a really nice word. So it's number 240. So what I'll do is read it out. It's not very long. And then we'll have some discussion around the theme. And we can see how it relates to our lives and whether we whether we can relate it to our lives or not. Sometimes it doesn't make sense and it's fine to ask about that too. So here we go. And again, most of you know me by now, I'm going to change the gender not neutral language to gender neutral language. Here we go. So it says bhikkhus, but I'll just say community. Community. In the past, a tortoise was searching for food along the bank of a river one evening. On that same evening, a jackal was also searching for food along the bank of that same river. When the tortoise saw the jackal in the distance, searching for food, it drew its limbs and neck inside its shell and passed the time keeping still and silent. The jackal had also seen the tortoise in the distance searching for food. So he approached and waited close by, thinking, when this tortoise extends one or another of its limbs or its neck, I will grab it right on the spot, pull it out, and eat it. But because the tortoise did not extend any of its limbs or its neck, the jackal, failing to gain access to it, lost interest in it and departed. So too, monastics or community, Mara, the evil one, is constantly and continually waiting close by you, thinking, perhaps I'll gain access to this person through the eye or through the ear, or through the nose, we've got dot, 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 or through the tongue, or through the body and the body feelings, or through the mind. That's five, you see, five external senses. Oh, no, it's six. Okay, well, imagine the tortoise has six limbs. Maybe it has a tail. Does it have a tail? Okay, so then it is six. Therefore, dwell guarding the doors of the sense faculties. Having seen a form with the eye, do not grasp its signs and features. Since if you leave the eye faculty unguarded, bad, I'm using bad instead of evil because it just sounds kind of like a bit extreme. Bad, unwholesome states of covetousness and displeasure might invade you. Practice the way of its restraint. Guard the eye faculty. Undertake the restraint of the eye faculty. I'm going to just pause here because straight away I'm kind of wanting to reinterpret or retranslate some of the words. So here it says, if you leave the eye faculty unguarded, these evil or bad unwholesome states of covetousness and displeasure might invade you. So this is this idea of abhijja domanasam, not avidya, but abhijja, B-H-I, abhijja domanasa. And unfortunately, this has often been translated as covetousness, and often it's translated as grief, covetousness and grief for the world. And actually what Pali scholars have discovered, particularly Ajahn Brahmali and Bhante Sajjato, and also Ajahn Brown, and Bhikkhu Bodhi agrees with this. So I don't know if this is an older translation, but when the pair is used together, abhijja domanasam, it usually is a synonym or a kind of a acronym, maybe, for the first, for the whole five hindrances, for all five hindrances. And it's basically identical to the first two, to craving and aversion. Yeah, so to the hindrance of kamachanda, which is kind of sensory desire, and the hindrance of avyapada, which is like ill will or aversion, negativity. Sometimes people call it hate, but it just means anything on the side of not liking as opposed to craving for. So that sounds to me a lot more relatable than something like covetousness and grief, you know, for the world. And the world, in most cases, here it doesn't say the world, but mostly it means craving and aversion to the world of the senses. So exactly what we're talking about here, these five senses mostly. And thoughts about that five sense world, because generally speaking, we want to cultivate the mind, and the pleasures of the mind are not something to be feared. So generally, when we talk about the kind of craving and aversion, we're talking about it in relation to the five senses, but also thoughts about the five senses, but not actually mental states of PT or inspiration or confidence. That's a different category. We don't have to overcome that. We're actually supposed to develop that. So that's the difference there. So it really means any of the five hindrances, but the first two are kind of include the rest. The rest, in a sense, are variations on craving and aversion. If you think about restlessness, it's a kind of not wanting to be where you are, right? Or it's a wanting to jump onto something better. Sloth and torpor is often a dulling out because you don't really like what you're with. You can't really see clearly enough to keep your mindfulness going. Or maybe you're depressed and you just get sleepy all the time because it's easier to just dull out and to feel the pain. So it can be a kind of aversion. And then, of course, there's doubt, which is a kind of confusion. I don't know whether that falls under craving or aversion. It's probably a bit of in the middle. It's more delusion-based, not really knowing the path, not really knowing what to do next, not having clarity of mind. So once craving and aversion are uprooted, then the others naturally go away. The others, in sense, are a little bit subtler, but also harder to perceive sometimes. You know, restlessness can be really subtle. It can be just a slight getting ahead of yourself, slightly kind of smearing into the future, a smearing of time. Does anyone recognize what I'm saying? It's like you're with the breath kind of, but you're also sort of anticipating the next part or the next breath. Or even just keeping one eye out on what's happening, what's going to happen. You're not quite in the present. And I love the simile Ajahn Brahm gives about it's kind of like you're looking, let's say binoculars, because we've got some binoculars now in the kitchen, and it's quite hard to look through them because they tend to be a bit bleary, and if you don't have them quite in the right position on your eyes, they wobble a bit. But what you can do if it's not super clear is just focus them in. So you just make that kind of focus that little bit sharper, and then everything comes into perspective. And that's kind of how it is when our mindfulness is smudged across a little bit of the future, a little bit of the past. It's a bit blurry. We don't see it clearly. So we just need to increase the definition and kind of drop in, if you like, closer to the present. And it's not a contracting kind of feeling. You don't feel like tight and constricted. You just feel a little bit more sharp. So it's a bit like, I mean, the simile he actually uses is not binoculars, but like a camera, you know, a camera lens that's not quite in focus, and just twist it around until you get that clarity. Anyway, I'm supposed to finish this, aren't I? So I'll continue with the other senses. The dot, dot, dots have come along, but I think it's nice to hear them all. And that way, we start to remember some of the phrase, some of the phrasing and terminology, and we can bring it up more readily when we need to. So we can start to learn what sense restraint is. So therefore, dwell guarding the doors of the sense faculties. So the next one is having heard a sound with the ear. Do not grasp at its signs and features, since if you leave the ear faculty unguarded, bad, unwholesome states of craving and aversion might invade you. Practice the way of its restraint. Guard the ear faculty. Undertake the restraint of the ear faculty. Sight, sound, smell. Having smelt an odor with the nose, do not grasp its signs and features. That's cumin. That's ginger. What else? That's lemon juice.
Horse poop.
Horse poo. She said horse poo. Could be. Ooh, that's horse poo. Since if you leave the nose faculty unguarded, even evil or bad unwholesome states of craving or sensual desire and aversion might invade you. Practice the way of its restraint. Guard the nose faculty. Having savoured a taste with the tongue. This is the hardest bit, isn't it? Like the nose, the tongue, it's all about food. Having savoured a taste with the tongue, do not grasp its signs and features, since if you leave the tongue faculty unguarded, bad unwholesome states of covetousness and displeasure or craving and aversion might invade you. Practice the way of its restraint. Guard the tongue faculty, I guess. Undertake the restraint of the tongue faculty. Having felt a tactile object with the body, and I do believe that includes any feelings that come through just through the body itself. So there might be objects coming in contact with our body internally, you know, for example, the food going through the intestines, or muscular pain, you know, contractions, even just tingling sensations. Sometimes, I mean, when you're really in meditation on the body, you can even feel energy or the breath moving through many parts of the body, even through the cells. Sometimes it can feel that way, or the blood, the liquids moving through the body. So bodily touch can happen internally as well. So having felt that tactile object with the body, pain, vibration, tingling, or maybe physical bodily touch of someone putting their hand on you, or wanted or unwanted. If you leave it unguarded, bad unwholesome states of craving and aversion might invade you. Practice the way of its restraint. Guard the body faculty and undertake the restraint of the body faculty. And lastly, having cognized a mental phenomenon with a mind, do not grasp its signs and features, since if you leave the mind faculty unguarded, bad unwholesome states of craving and aversion might invade you. Practice the way of restraint. Guard the mind faculty. Undertake the restraint of the mind faculty. Much harder to do. When you dwell, guarding the doors of the sense faculties, marvel at the evil one, failing to gain access to you, will lose interest in you and depart, just as the jackal departed from the tortoise. And then there's a little poem to end. Drawing in the mind's thoughts as a tortoise draws its limbs into its shell. Independent, not harassing others, fully quenched. Such a person would not blame anyone. So there we go. Even this is culminating in full liberation, it seems. Fully quenched, fully cooled. And I do think of this as more like cooling off the senses. So I'm aware I've spoken quite a lot and there might be some questions or comments already. So I'll pause and open up to everybody here. And before you do have your hand up, I'll just say that there's a lovely sutta, I think it's also in this chapter, called the Fire Sermon. And it actually does say that the senses are on fire with greed, with hate, or if you like, craving, aversion, and delusion. So the idea of quenching is very similar to the idea of cooling those fires of the senses. And I think for me, this sutta is more talking about the senses in and of themselves being conducive to suffering. It's not only the way we use them, but it's the senses themselves, because here we're talking about really drawing them in and waiting for the danger to pass. Something similar to what we do on retreat, isn't it? We actually really limit the amount of sensory input we have. And I was just asking the people here if they would kindly pass me their mobile phones, not because I want extra ones, but so that I can put them away in a little box and we can, really have a bit of solitude for the senses as well as for our physical bodies in general. So I think this is a very beautiful sutta. The other thing that came to mind is a couple of things. A comment by one of my trustees today, who's also quite busily involved in the project with selling the old Vihara that we had in Oxford. And she said, I'll be really glad when the sale's over. And I said, yeah, it has been going on a while. She said, yeah, it's just that I like to tick things off my list. And I said, I totally get that. Isn't it wonderful when we can just like cross something off and there's less to do? And it's not that we, you know, have the wrong attitude about what we're doing. It's just there is a certain peace. There's a certain quietening of the senses when there's something less to do. And I feel the same way about emails. You know, I have so many emails and I love to go through them, answer as quickly as I can and just, okay, delete. It's gradually drawing in your senses, isn't it? It's gradually drawing away from that world that's kind of demanding your attention, demanding your decisions, and making you use your tired eyes and brain, and just deleting. One less thing to do, one more thing, business settled and stilled. Yeah. I like that simile, you know, it drew its limbs and neck inside its shell and passed the time keeping still and silent, just drawing in away from the world. I even had my 13-year-old niece here like 2 days ago. I think they left yesterday, actually. They were here for one night. And I thought, gosh, she's 13. I think she's going to find it so boring here. But amazingly, she would actually take herself off for quiet time. Up to the room. I felt very happy to see she was at home and she'd sort of come back a bit early from a walk, or she'd take herself off away from everyone else for a while. And she found a little spot behind her bed. So I'd open the door and I wouldn't see her in there. It's a big room. And it'd be like, where is she? And she'd be hiding sort of between the bed and the cupboard. She found what she called a den. And she'd just stay there sort of on her belly, probably looking at her phone. But anyway, just for quiet time, just for being on her own. And it occurred to me that that too is a kind of, a disengagement from the senses to some extent. All right, so I'm coming to Shalina, and then I shall come to the chat. Lovely to hear someone else's voice. Hi.
Venerable, about the not giving attention to the signs and features. That mindfulness, the continuity of that at all the sense doors means that the mind moves less and less and less, and that it sort of leads to samadhi itself, isn't it?
That's really a good point.
I think that's really what the main thing is.
Yeah, that's a really excellent point, actually, because often I think of not giving attention to the signs and features sort of, I guess it depends at which level of the training we're working, but I often think of it as not giving attention to the signs and features in a way that stimulates the unwholesome states. But of course, that will naturally lead to the mind quietening. And actually, even just not giving attention to the signs and features is already a quietening, isn't it? Because you're seeing a more kind of generalized view. You're not getting, I think Ajahn Brahm sometimes translates it as getting sucked in to the signs and features, which is also great. It's like you're not giving them too much importance in a way. And so, yeah, you're quite right. The mind develops a greater equanimity and steadiness whilst it is usually pulled around. And you know, like with the simile of the ropes, isn't it? If you're giving so much attention to the signs, you're really getting pulled to that sense. Whereas if you have a more generalized perspective, the senses are perhaps more balanced as well. Perhaps your awareness is more balanced between the senses, so to speak. But yeah, completely agree that that will lead to a quietening of the mind. Yeah. Thank you. I'll come to the people with their hands up just because it's nice to hear someone else speak, but I won't neglect the comments in the box. Hi, Minori.
Hello, Venerable. Could you expand on being kind of gentle with us while kind of restraining the senses? Because sometimes you can be really tough on you trying to restrain the senses, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, maybe that relates a little bit to what Shalina was saying about not necessarily pulling ourselves back, but perhaps not just getting obsessed with particular signs and features, kind of seeing them for what they are, maybe seeing the danger in, you know, grasping, seeing the danger in getting, you know, too enamored or, you know, in wholesome, unwholesome states per se. I mean, that would especially relate to the mind, I think, as well, you know, that we need to keep a watch on the way we're reacting. And if it's starting to lead to unwholesome ways of thinking, actually, potentially substitute those thoughts and look at things a different way. Seeing the danger as well. I mean, that's one of the ways of overcoming unwholesome thoughts. Realizing that this way of thinking is actually not for my own well-being. It's leading away from Nibbana. It's leading to more suffering. I think that's really important. Not just kind of saying this is bad, it's not good for me, I shouldn't, but actually seeing why the Buddha says this. And this is why I sometimes don't like this translation, evil or even bad unwholesome states. Because the main thing the Buddha's trying to emphasize here is that it will lead to our suffering. They're bad in the sense, and they're unwholesome in the sense that the craving and aversion may arise, and it actually says invade you. It may invade you. Because there's another lovely sutta where the Buddha says, you know, we should take care that the hindrances do not invade the mind and remain. They might come up, but we shouldn't let them get carried away. You know, we shouldn't give our mind over to them and allow them to just quickly develop. It's another simile Ajahn Brahm gives about this train. When it's leaving the station in the beginning, you see it leaving, it's leaving fairly slowly. So the thoughts start and they start fairly slowly. It's like, I'm not sure I feel very comfortable with this person. And after a while, it's like, actually, this person did this and then they did that. And, blah, blah, blah. And it's harder and harder to stop it. So being gentle also can mean, you know, just seeing it in the beginning, reminding yourself, this is not for my own well-being. This is going to hurt myself and potentially someone else. And that can sometimes be enough. There's a lot more compassion in that than force, I think. Does that make sense? Okay, I come to Johnny.
Well, thank you for the talk. So I have an observation and a question.
Okay.
Observation first. Just picking up on what you're talking about in relation to giving attention to signs and features and samadhi. How that landed for me was, that's really interesting, but it feels like if I'm getting entangled in something, it's like there's kind of absence of mindfulness, an absence of awareness there.
Yeah.
And it's like when the attention actually comes to what's going on, that's the moment when I can kind of release it. So I guess I'd just be interested in how you would reconcile the two, two points.
Yeah, great question. Actually, guarding the senses and mindfulness always come together as a pair in the gradual training. They kind of whirl around each other. The more we're able to develop our mindfulness, the quicker we can see what our mind is being pulled to or repelled from. And the more we're able to kind of draw in those senses, the less mindfulness is leaking out into the sense world. And so the more energized the mind becomes, because you're quite right, if you're kind of leaking out, so to speak, into the sense world, your energy is leaking out there. We lose our mindfulness over time. I've noticed that so many times, you know, especially say, actually when the mind is in a wholesome way, I can start to feel, especially say at the end of a retreat or if there's some PT arising, in the beginning, I start to see a lot of beauty in nature. I start to feel a lot of gratitude towards people. But then if I let it go too far, I start looking at people too much, having too many good thoughts, even good thoughts. And I actually find that I'm running too fast with that pleasant sensation. I'm getting kind of entangled, and the energy that gave rise to the joy in the first place is starting to dissipate. So I think sometimes we need to keep that energy inside and not allow it to leak. There's another sutta where the Buddha does talk about mindfulness being like in a bucket, and you know, the loss of mindfulness through a lack of sense restraint being like leaks in the bucket. So it's not only that we need to build our mindfulness through meditation or through being aware of what's happening in the day, or mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of the breath, but we also need to see how it leaks out into the realm of the five senses. And I think here that's also referred to here, isn't it? That if you stick it out, you know, too far, you stick your limb out when there's a jackal there, there's a potential that it's going to get sucked into a pleasant sight or smell or whatever, then I mean, maybe that's not as harmful as getting sucked into, say, lustful thoughts, or, you know, even a more dangerous situation where you're likely to break your precepts, you know, or likely to say something really harmful to another person. Then it's really important, if there's a danger of that, to see the potential danger and to just, yeah, keep a watch over that particular sense door. Does that make sense? So mindfulness, yeah, sati sampajanya and sense restraint usually go together. Usually it's sense restraint and sati sampajanya, but often it's the other way around. So they have to go together. Mindfulness is like the guard for all the other, it's kind of like the watch person, or the, you know, the thing that looks over all the other qualities being developed. Yeah. I'm coming to the chat and then I'll come to Karin. Please keep your hand up. So may we discuss concrete examples of sense restraint from the life of Venerable Sariputta, such as how he reacted when someone smacked him hard on the back and kept walking, or when his mother verbally abused him while feeding him and remained silent. Yeah, that's great, isn't it? That's a good one. The second one, or both of them. But I like the second one because you mentioned the word silent, and that's what he did. That was definitely a kind of restraint. So the Venerable Sariputta was the Buddha's right-hand monk disciple. I usually say right-hand disciple. Right-hand monk disciple. We had right-hand female ones too, bhikkhuni disciples too. That was Venerable Kema, who was foremost in wisdom. So just as Venerable Sariputta was foremost in wisdom in the monks. And he had obviously developed his faculties to a very high degree because he was fully enlightened. So one time there was, I think, some kind of yakka, wasn't it? Wasn't it some kind of yakka that hit him in the back? They were like, this Sariputta, he reckons to be an arahat. I'll prove that he's not. And he came along the street, or invisibly, presumably, and just whacked him, gave him a real blow in the back. And actually, I think it was on the head, wasn't it? Yeah, I think it was on the back of the head, like, boof, enough to give him a mighty headache. But he just carried on walking. And then somebody said, you know, when that happened, how did you feel? How could you keep walking? Why didn't you react? And he just said, oh, yeah, I just felt it was just pain. It was just a blow on the head. And I just carried on, something like this. And then, yeah, another time his mother, he went to his parents' house to receive the day's food. And I'm not sure if he went there out of compassion to them or they sort of roughly invited him, as in roughly with a, you know, in a rough way. But he went there to receive the meal and his mother basically put it in his bowl very roughly, literally kind of, you good for nothing, recluse, you bald-headed, useless, waste of a son, but still put the food in. And he just remained quiet. And it wasn't actually until his parinibbana that his mother started to realize who her son was, because she saw all these incredible heavenly beings coming down from their various realms to pay respects to her son. And she was thinking, what is going on here? Aren't these the gods that I worship? Aren't these the heavenly beings themselves? And they're paying respect to my son. Who on earth was my son? And that was when she realized that, you know, her son was actually worthy of respect. And I think she probably started to follow the Dhamma at that point. But I don't remember the exact details. But partly, you know, it would have tallied in, right? Because then she would have thought, well, even when I treated my son in this way that he didn't deserve, he remained silent. He didn't react. He didn't try to, you know, embarrass me or reject me or anything like that. Whereas if you would have got upset at that point, which most of us probably would, then she might have got a question mark about whether her son was really enlightened. So, yeah, he was a very, very inspiring monk and withstood a lot of abuse, as did the Buddha, a lot of verbal abuse. And do you know that story about the Brahmin Bharadvaja, I think. Bharadvaja, yeah. I know Shalina does. She's smiling a lot. And I think Diana does too, because we're all from the Goenka thing. And he talks about that a lot. It's a really beautiful story. I mean, he kind of makes it relate to the Vipassana method. But basically, this Bharadvaja was one of the Brahmins. There's a few different Bharadvajas in the suttas. But this one was a Brahmin and quite proud. But he came to the Buddha and actually got really influenced by the Buddha's teachings. And I'm not sure if he was already a stream winner by then, but he went to his family and, you know, they could see that he'd changed and he was no longer doing his Brahmin rituals, no longer kind of, you know, bathing in the holy rivers to cleanse his sins or whatever else they did. And they thought, well, who is this Buddha? He's ruining our tradition. You know, now that our son, our father, whatever, doesn't do these rites and rituals that are going to purify his soul. This is terrible. The Buddha's terrible. And is this the right one? Is this the right story? Oh, no, I've done it wrong. This is the later part, isn't it?
Huh? I think the children are all followers of the Buddha.
Oh, no, I forget. Oh, that's right. Is it that the parents or the friends of Bharadvaja go to the Buddha and start to abuse him? Is that right? I might be mixing up my stories now. But I think basically the kind of gist of the story is that they go to the Buddha and they're really angry and they say, you know, you're spoiling our tradition, et cetera, et cetera. And the Buddha basically says, listen, does anybody come to your house as a visitor? And they say, yes, 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 they come to our house as a visitor. So what? You know, we're really, really angry. You, Buddha, you're useless. You're, you know, ruining our tradition and all the rest. And then the Buddha said, but Brahmin, don't people come with gifts to your house? So what? What's this got to do with it? You're ruining our religion. And then he says, well, when they bring gifts, what happens if you don't accept those gifts? Well, they remain with us, of course. If they don't accept them, they remain with us. And then the Buddha says, well, just in the same way you came here offering all your gifts of abuse and I have not accepted them, they remain with you, Brahmin. They remain with you. So this was his way of restraint. He didn't get angry, but he was very smart in the way he tried to teach the Dhamma to this Brahmin or the Brahmin's family and bring him round. So I actually think that happened first, and it was that Brahmin that then became converted. The family didn't like it, etc. But this was an example of the Buddha's restraint. So it was very sharp, and not only was he able to naturally not move into craving and aversion because he was now out by then, he also had the presence of mind and the compassion to be able to teach the Dhamma in a really effective way that made sense to this person. So that's another level, isn't it? That's really another level when you can actually turn things around. All right, I'm going to carry on with a chat question, which has been there a while. The to-do list always grows, though. That's one of my problems. I get it. You might be thinking, she gets it, she's a nun. Trust me, I know. Sometimes I need to leave everything as it is and stop. Yeah. Ticking things off a list becomes addictive as it gives a buzz. That's a really good point, actually, because you can never really get to the end of the checklist. And Ajahn Brahm's been telling me that for years. He says, you know, you just have to stop at some point. And I do. I mean, we do meditate, and we are having a week-long retreat very soon. And yeah, sometimes there's a sort of buzz to it, and actually if you get addicted to that buzz, you end up wanting to find more things to do to tick off your list. And when your list is finished, you're a bit kind of lost, and then you start buzzing around the house, watering plants and cleaning surfaces, right? We become compulsive tick off the listers. But I agree, the list is never finished, and at some point we just have to stop. Isn't it? We just have to stop and say, what's done is finished. I'll just go to one more in the chat because it's an important one. Can you explain signs? Signs and features. So I don't know what it says in the commentaries, but the way I've learned it from Ajahn Brahmali is that, I mean, I think they're both pointing to the same thing, really, but signs is more like the generalized, a more generalized kind of attributes of something. So signs might be like, oh, this is a woman with nice eyes or something, or just this is a woman. I don't know if you're a heterosexual man. And then features might be like, oh, might even be this is a pretty woman. Features is more like beautiful eyes, the way she walks, the sound of the voice, something like this. So it's just basically all those little attributes that make something enticing and appealing, as opposed to just seeing sight as sight. Okay. That's a good one. The tortoise must have well-established mindfulness to have seen the jackals so far off. Yeah. That's good, isn't it? If we don't see the danger, we don't have time to protect the senses. Good one. Yeah, very true. And we get wiser and wiser in seeing the danger as we grow in the Dhamma. You know, we start to be able to differentiate the dangerous from the less dangerous. I mean, it's one of the virtues of having good friends. If we're able to surround ourselves, protect ourselves with good friends and people who support us in the Dhamma, then somebody else who is maybe a little undermining or maybe a little passive aggressive or maybe a lot, quickly stands out as a danger to what we've already established. So in the same way, I think we need to establish a sense of obviously mindfulness, but also well-being to some extent, and be less willing to compromise that well-being as we see the danger to it. So yeah, that's also where mindfulness comes in. If we don't see the danger, we don't have time to protect the senses. And yet still, I mean, we don't only have to protect them by drawing them in. Sometimes we're in the world and there's so many distracting sights, sounds, smells, tastes, touches, and thoughts. And sometimes we are in the thick of it. And even just knowing that we're in the thick of it is a type of mindfulness. Even just kind of slowing down our reactions is a kind of progress on the path. Even if you react sometimes, but not every time, the way you used to do, it's also progress on the path. So it's not all or nothing. So yeah, don't lose heart. Yeah. Karin, can I ask you to unmute?
No, thank you, Venerable. I wonder whether you could share your views on a specific situation. So I'm applying what we heard today to a situation where, for example, if we find ourselves in a hospital, in a care home, where we in an environment which is full of sense deprivation, where we which is an environment which we can't influence, which we are exposed to. And I guess the only refuge is the mindfulness. So there might be issues of difficult patients on the ward, or perhaps the bedside manner of medical staff, pain, medication, all of this. What would be your recommendation for somebody who, unlike the tortoise, hasn't perhaps established a solid foundation in mindfulness?
Yeah, thanks. Wonderful question. You know, interestingly, and I'm sorry if you're having to deal with these kind of situations, because it's very difficult if the input is generally negative and maybe not very much wholesome or, you know, stimulating sensory input, but rather quite difficult input to deal with, or very little input, even a sense of coldness or, you know, a lack of care. This is really tough, especially if we're sick ourselves. Our mindfulness isn't going to be as strong, and that's sometimes physiological, and I think we have to really cut ourselves some slack. But it's interesting, because when you did say, I suppose the only protection is the mindfulness, I thought you were going to say the mind, because that was what came to my mind. And remember that there's mindfulness, but there's also cultivation. Mindfulness is not only just being aware, but it's being aware in a certain way. It's being aware kindly. It's being aware with kindness. It's cultivating the wholesome states. That's one of the purposes of mindfulness, is to remember the instructions and to develop the wholesome states. So I would say that it's possible, if there isn't any very resourcing sensory input for you, that it's possible, hopefully, in times that you're quiet and have time to practice, to actually recollect wholesome states in the past, even drawing or creating a mental picture with beautiful imagery of a safe place, a place with beautiful trees or sunlight coming through the trees. Maybe there's some nice smells of flowers. Maybe you live by the river, I know. So maybe water, you know, the river flowing quietly, or maybe even a time that you've been with beautiful people, friends that have given you support and encouragement, maybe recalling their words. So you can actually bring up other perceptions of the sensory world that are resourcing. And of course, even more than sensual sort of imagery, you could perhaps bring up thoughts of the Dhamma, you know, thoughts of compassion and the benefits of compassion. times you've seen compassion being displayed. You could bring up, I don't know, feelings that you've had in your meditation, feelings of safety, feelings of peace. Just remind yourself of that word, peace. You know, sit there and say peace, or thoughts of loving kindness. So we can do a lot with our mind. I would say, especially resourcing yourself with kindness, with compassion, would be quite key in that situation. And yeah, if you feel that the senses are being sort of becoming sluggish, or, you know, the sensory input is causing you to feel depressed and tired, then maybe bring up some beautiful imagery as well. Even colors can help. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Thank you. Yes.
At all applicable?
Yes, because it's the onslaught of noise and light.
Yeah.
Relentlessly, the smells.
Yeah.
Thankfully, I don't find myself very much in that place, but I am supporting people who do. And so therefore the mental distress physiologically also can be so heightened. It's quite difficult to sort of just to gently, but I guess it's this.
I wonder if it's also possible to somehow, like you made like this, it's hard to, and I was thinking, you know, is it somehow possible to find a place underneath the noise, like to find something that's not noisy, like even something in the body? I remember one of my yoga teachers, she was great. She's the best yoga teacher I've ever had, actually. She was a proper yoga teacher who studied for 40 years. And she used to say, listen to the silence that is in your body. I just think that's really strange, the silence that is in your body. But then I realized, actually, that whole realm of feelings and of the body is pretty quiet, actually, and it's in there. It's in there. It really opened my mind up to noticing the silence outside, to the point where even when there was noise, and perhaps not as relentless as the noise you're describing, but it was almost as though noise was contained within this bigger sphere of silence. Like I could hear this background kind of hum and silence, and the sounds that would come in would kind of come in but not actually destroy that silence. I don't know if that makes sense, but it opened that perception up for me. I don't know, it could be helpful just to realize that in you, even in your mind, from time to time there are moments of silence, and see if you can just gently incline to that. Because it is so easy to kind of get fixated on those things, right? Especially if it's there all the time. It sort of fills the mind. But there are moments that it's a little quieter, or, you know, maybe you could just perceive it as some kind of background hum.
Yeah.
I think it's a matter of playing with perception a little bit as well. Anyone else have ideas? I don't know.
Thank you.
There's lots more ideas in the room. Someone's just clarified a couple of the comments in the box. The yakka smacked the Venerable Sariputta on the head during meditation. The Brahmin smacked him on the back during arms round. Thanks. So there's two different things here. So even Venerable Sariputta got smacked. It's shocking. Is it shocking? I don't know. We sometimes think, oh, if I get enlightened, if only, I'll have a much better life. Well, the external might not change too much. But your attitude and response will make all the difference. It will be incredibly different, and probably you'll have a lot of compassion for those people that smack you in the back, so to speak. And then around the question of the buzz of ticking things off, it's a buzz and also a distraction. That's very true. Yeah. And the buzz again is sometimes like the energy just dissipating very fast. You know, it's like there's a quick buzz. What does the Buddha say? Appo, sukha, bahu, dukkha. A little bit of happiness and then a lot of a crash. I find that when you're sort of on an adrenaline sort of, I mean, a lot of my life, honestly, I'm just exhausted. And it is, I know that it's adrenaline taking me through. And I also know that when I stop, I'll have a few days where I'm just exhausted. And then it picks up and regulates again. So some of the stuff is unavoidable, but we have to be careful about that, especially on Facebook and stuff that gives you a really cheap dopamine hit. And then you're looking for more of it by scrolling again. So someone's saying perhaps reducing the senses with personal protective gear. Yeah, that's a good one. In the workplace. Yeah, yeah, that's possible. Or even play some kind of Dhamma talk or chanting to yourself. Yeah. Yeah, reducing the sensory input. People do that. Ajahn Brahm's cave is soundproofed, double soundproofed. And it's not that he can't make peace with noise. I've seen him in the middle of teaching, you know, and going to some very noisy places. And I said to him, gosh, when you're on retreat, you go here, don't you feel, you know, a bit agitated? How do you deal with it? It's like, oh, you just make peace with the noise. But it doesn't mean you can't do that if it helps. You don't have to tolerate it. Can we discuss body, speech, and mind in relation to sense restraint if we're resentful of someone's speech and appreciate their bodily acts of generosity? That's a form of sense restraint. Good. Fascinating. So grateful for the expanded understanding. This is directly mentioned, not with those particular examples, but actually more or less this exact theme is mentioned in a sutta in the, I think, Anguttas. It's Sariputta teaches six ways. And it's the one, I think that's the name of it, because there are two different ones for overcoming resentment. But the one that's the venerable, I'm not sure if he teaches both of them. Okay, five. Is it the five? It's not the one metta, karuna, upekkha, etc. It's the one about the similes of the cloth. So basically, you're walking along the road. This one monk, I suppose, is walking along the road. Let's say a bhikkhuni. And they see, okay, good. All right, so one is the Buddha, one is Sariputta. I think the Sariputta's one is where he talks about a monastic walking along the road and they see a piece of cloth and it's actually pretty filthy. But they think, well, actually, if I just hold that cloth down with my foot, with my second foot, I can tear off the other piece of cloth, which is less dirty, and then I can wash it and make use of it. So they actually remove the dirty piece of cloth and they make use and clean and stitch a robe out of the good piece of cloth. So this is an example of noticing that somebody's speech might be unwholesome, dirty as such, but their bodily acts are good. So we can actually focus on the good in that person instead of just focusing on the things that irritate us, the things that we find to fault. And then it gives another simile, which is similar, about a person who has really good speech, but their bodily acts are not impure. And then there's one where both speech and body is impure. There's one where even when it's, yeah, but they still sometimes get an opening of mind, which means they still sometimes have a mind state which is more or less free from the hindrances. But it's harder to actually see that person's good. So then the simile is like a cow on four legs. You have to kind of get down to this puddle. It's like a dirty puddle. You want to drink water from it and you have to cup your two hands and sip from the top of this dirty water. So it's much, much harder, in other words, to actually see any good in that person. And then when there really is no good at all, we have to have compassion as if that person's a sick person. So a sick person without a nurse, without an attendant, which is a simile for kind of spiritual friends, without medicine, similarly for not having the Dhamma, without a teacher, without the Buddha's teaching. And then the last one is that the person actually has pure body and verbal action and they do get an opening, but still you resent them. So this happens. This is what was happening just now to the Venerable Sariputta, to the Buddha, to, you know, all kinds of people who are projected onto, because people don't always like it if someone's pure. Maybe they're jealous. Maybe they want to prove that they're not pure and kind of trip them up somehow. So even then we can have resentment. And one of the ways to overcome that is to go to them as shelter, as refuge, and sit under the shade of their tree. It's like they're a shady tree that you can actually go and take shelter and take inspiration from. So rather than feel jealous, let's go to them and ask for teachings. Let's actually humble ourselves a little bit so that we can receive some of the happiness that they have inside, which means, yeah, also noticing that perhaps there is something pure there. All right, I'm going to go just to the questions, especially those who haven't contributed so far, and then we need to start winding up. But it's enough, I hope, to get you interested in this theme, which is a really big field for practice, because it's really the whole of our life, isn't it, when we're involved in the sense world. As long as your eyes are open or one of the senses is switched on, it's the whole of our lives. So in meditation, you know, it might not be such an active practice, but even between the meditations, when we go from our cushion to the kitchen, we can see what our senses are playing with, and we can notice how we're allowing them to run and how we can just quieten them down. Will it help to observe or focus on the noise? Yeah, I'm not sure. That's one for Karin to figure out, I guess. I'm not actually sure about that, because I'm presuming there's a lot else going on that you need to make the center of your focus. But try it out. Try different things. Someone else is saying, I have an alarm on my phone during the morning and afternoon reminding me to pause and breathe. Excellent. It can help me ground me and bring me back to the moment. I sometimes then think about gratitude or looking out of the window to nature. Yeah, that's great, isn't it? I really find that so helpful when I remember to look outside and actually look at the view. That's been shown to reset the nervous system too. You just need to change the scope of your awareness, like looking at a horizon in particular, or looking at trees, looking at things in the distance. And today, actually, we all in the kitchen, because we didn't have any, sorry to say, male guest. There was a male guest. It's a bit different when there's a male guest. When it's just back to like four females together and there's a pause moment, we just decided, let's stretch a little bit, because these are all good friends of mine. So we just started to stretch, and it was really nice. And it's like, oh, I like to stretch this way, I like to stretch that way. So we all got into a little bit of stretching, and it was just 5 or 10 minutes, but it actually replaced not necessarily my need, but the desperation for having a nap, because it rejuvenated my energy temporarily. And that was really nice. It just gets you back in your body and out of this kind of diversity of the sensual world. Yeah. I appreciate your bad mouth nurse caring for an elderly patient example, venerable. Yeah, that's a long time ago, isn't it? Yeah, a long, long time ago. But the last job I ever had, actually, well, I suppose I worked, no, it was the last job I ever had, paid. 2001, sorry to make everyone jealous. This is quite a hard job, trust me. That was easier. Yeah, this was a fellow care worker in a nursing home for people. Really sort of last step before one-to-one care was needed, and probably it was needed, but because of the health system, there were sort of 40 people in this elderly, mentally infirm nursing home. So they had dementia quite advanced. And one of the nurses, yeah, she would effing blind, really coarse, really, really coarse, but gosh, she cared. She really gave a whole heart to caring for those people. She could, you know, swear her mouth off. And at first I was a little bit shocked, because my family, you know, if you say an F word, it's like almost you get kicked out, I should imagine. I did want to say that to my mom once, and my goodness, I was scared. I was really scared. I knew I'd completely overshot the boundary. I didn't even say it to her, like, you. It was just, I was frustrated and said the word. Oh my goodness. So yeah, I was a bit shocked. And then I noticed that, you know, she came from this kind of, she was a single mother of many kids, and she was basically saying she could earn more in a supermarket, but how could she just leave these people that she'd come to love, and someone had to do it, and she just wanted them to be clean, to retain their dignity. And she would be working hard on these 12-hour shifts throughout the night. And yeah, we did have to clean their fingernails of feces. Sometimes it was pretty bad. I won't go into detail, but it was shocking, actually. And no matter how dirty the job, she would just put everything into it to give these people their dignity. It was amazing. She became a friend. Okay, gosh, we've gone over time. I find memory very helpful, not necessarily recalling experiences, but having memorized some beautiful poems. They're a wholesome distraction. And I also find the act of recalling or reciting by heart is like a massage for the mind. Yeah, great. When in places without beauty, it's wonderful to carry around a stash of beauty in the mind. That's great. Hard to guard the senses with long conditioning as a chef. Don't worry about that. That's only one of the senses. As long as you're not stealing food from anyone, it's probably not going into breaking your precepts. Don't worry too much. I found that if anything happens to upset me or grab my attention, I use it to bring me back to the present moment of mindfulness in a good way. Excellent. Yeah, that's the thing, isn't it? When we find our mind astrayed, at some point we go, whoops. And instead of condemning ourselves, we say, great, it's an opportunity to start again. It's a moment of realizing that we were moving in unwholesome ways. Yeah, wanting others to be clean and keep their dignity. Thank you. That's a helpful perception. Wonderful. So we've come to the end, and I will ask Manuri to say a few words before I will update you on the next events.
Yeah, so a few words from me about generosity. Giving the whole thrust of the practice, a direction we move in, and develops wholesome qualities that form the foundation of Dhamma practice. So that is the reason for generosity. And generosity can also be a practice for checking in deeply with us. So it's just practice for yourself. For example, we might reflect on what has really helped and inspired us in our life so far. So many varieties of generosity. So here at Anukampa, we offer several ways as well, so you can cultivate this beautiful quality of giving. Financially, there's one-time donations of any amount, and you can press that link that Matthias put, and you can do donations in different ways, bank transfers, PayPal, and we have SumUp now as well for anybody who can't do bank transfers or PayPal. So bank transfers is the nicest way because we don't get charged. And then you can, if possible, if it allows you, you can do standing orders, regular donations. That will help us in managing the day-to-day operations and day-to-day small events. Offering your time is another one. So you can volunteer and you can organize events, help to organize events. So that's another way. So there is an email, team@anukampa.org. So if you are a volunteer, if you want to volunteer, if you are good at something, please let them know. And then we can put you in the volunteer database. And also you can provide meals to the monastics, either in person or, like a cooked meal, or you can deliver. You can do it remotely as well. And there is a list of needed items in the website. You can see that. And you can have a look and see whether you can give any needed items as well. So there's so many other things that Anukampa offers you. So this is a community which goes in both ways. You can register for special retreats that we post online. You can attend our weekly metta chanting on Wednesdays, sutta discussions on Fridays, and then silent meditations on Tuesdays and Thursdays, as well as metta meditation on some Saturdays. And make sure that you have a look at our newsletter, subscribe to the newsletter so you can see all these lovely news, pieces of community news, and you won't miss any of these things. And I wish you well in your practice, and thank you for the support.
Thank you, Manuri. Yeah, and thank you for your support at the latest little auction we did online. We had this lovely session with Ajahn Brahm for a couple of hours, and it was really heartwarming to receive so much support and goodwill, and also for the gift items that have been sent to us to help us set up this monastery for our constant flow of guests at this point. It's been really, again, heartwarming, and I've kept all your little messages. There's like more than 100 gifts, from beds to bedding to heaters to USB sticks, mold deterrents, because we've got loads of little moles, but they're so cute. I've actually not seen them, but it's almost nice thinking of them under the grass. But sometimes we do put our foot down into a hole because they're really going for it. Anyway, all very humane. And yeah, I just wanted to bring your attention to the fact that there's a little documentary being made by a Singaporean supporter. She actually came here 2 weeks after we moved in last March, and she's made a little kind of documentary stroke video thing of various footage she got at that time and some lovely photos showing how Anacompa has basically how it began and the journey so far. And that will be on our YouTube channel on Sunday. So she's releasing it there, first of all, and then on their own channel in Singapore to try and just bring in a bit more interest and support, etc., etc. And there's also some footage of the area we want to develop for Nons Cooties at the bottom of our property, and potentially an office as well that's separate from the house. So we actually had a builder come around today, and it was so exciting to talk to him about, you know, the prospect of what we could build and how and where, and just to envisage this place having so many more facilities for trainees, which is going to start to happen, and sooner than later. So that's the next sort of project we have in mind. And yeah, somebody's asked about another payment method. Yeah, donation, ways to donate are online. And I'm going to be doing a metta meditation tomorrow morning. So although we start our retreat tonight, I'll still be sort of starting off really with a metta session for everyone here and for all of you, if you're able to join in your time zone. And then next Wednesday, Minori will kindly lead the metta chanting. And next Friday, no sutta discussion, but there will be also a metta meditation the following Saturday. So metta meditation this Saturday, chanting on Wednesday, metta meditation next Saturday. And the following Friday, Anagarika Upachala will lead the sutta discussion for you all. So lovely to see you all. Thank you so much for being here, and take care of yourselves and each other. Take care.